This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Statio. Few articles of clothing get as much attention as the Muslim headscarf, and some scholars say few things are as misunderstood. UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University are holding a conference called Reorienting the Veil today and tomorrow. The event is meant to create a space for an interdisciplinary discussion of the Muslim headscarf. Two of the conference organizers join us on the program today. Sahar Amer is a professor of Asian Studies and French and Francophone Studies at UNC. Banu Gurkaraksel is a professor of geography there. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sahar, I want to start with you with a personal story, actually, because you don't wear a headscarf today, but I know there was a time when you did. Describe that decision to wear a headscarf and what that experience was.
Yes, this is probably one of the stories of my life that very few people know about. It was in 1983-84, and I was a sophomore in college in the U.S. at Bryn Mawr College, and I was after a trip to Egypt during the summer, I decided to wear the veil, the headscarf there. And there are probably two reasons mainly that pushed me to take that decision, which is one of them was when I was at Bryn Mawr, I was the president of the Muslim Student Association, and I was looked upon to provide guidance to a lot of the Muslim students at the university. We didn't have really anybody to look up to or to ask any questions to, but I was, because I was a native speaker of Arabic, everybody looked up to me to provide answers. So I had been exploring my religious background a lot during that time, and I was leading the prayer, for example, for the Muslim students there. And so that was one reason, I think, that when I went to Egypt, I was exploring that identity. And it was also the period of time when most people my age, so in their 20s, were also beginning to wear the headscarf. Mm. So I was, I guess, imitating them in many ways at the time.
And when you talk about a headscarf in this particular, instance, and when I know you came back for a year of college and wore the headscarf, was your face covered in any way, or it was just around the head?
Just around the head, and not even the neck in most of the time. Mm-hmm. Although I wore different variations of the headscarf, I never covered my face at that time. Very few people. In Egypt, certainly covered their face.
And this, you only wore it for a year back in the U.S. Why was that? What happened when you came back?
Well, when I came back, I was shocked at all of the attention I started to draw. Mm. And I mean, at the time, there was no Islamophobia, so I can't say that, you know, I had horrible events happening to me. But a lot of curiosity, a lot of people, like every day I had to explain several times why I was wearing it, and to explain and to represent all of Muslims, and in my own reasons, had become the voice for all of Islam. And I was starting to feel more and more uncomfortable with that, because wearing it in Egypt was one thing, but wearing it in the U.S. was an entirely different experience.
It became the defining characteristic.
That's right.
Banu, let's talk about some of the misconceptions about veiling. I mean, there are assumptions that some people make about women who veil, especially in non-Muslim majority societies.
There are lots of stereotypical assumptions that are made about veiled Muslim women. And one of that is actually something that Sahar touched upon, that when a woman is veiled in a recognizably Muslim way, then immediately she is taken as representative of all of Muslims and all of Muslim women, which is, of course, a big task and leads to this ideas about universalism that she can represent of diversity of Muslims, which, of course, she cannot. And a lot of my research, I found a lot of women talking about that responsibility that they feel is too much for them. And of course, the biggest stereotypical stereotype of the veil is that it is a sign of oppression of women. But in my research, I actually find women quite actively involved in their own veiling, and do not see it as a sign of oppression at all. It is actually very important to them for their religious practice, to their aesthetic concerns, to their formation of the self, their notions about who they are, so that they many of their actually positioning challenges those stereotypes. So those are, I think, the biggest, I think, too.
Well, and how do those misconceptions in say non-Muslim majority societies and in Western societies, how does that compare to what are perceptions of the veil within Muslim societies and within the Arab world?
I can speak for Turkey, and in Turkey, the stereotype of the veil is actually quite similar to the one that you would find in Western European societies. And it's mostly related to the history of secularism in Turkey, which tried to make a clear break with the Ottoman past and adopted these new ideas of modernism and secularism as its foundational principles, and made the veil as something of the past, as something that the Republic was trying to get away from. So the veil was then understood as something that was against the secular Republic and everything that it stood for. So the veil continues to be stigmatized in Turkey today, even though the first lady, the president's wife, and the prime minister's wife wears the headscarf, which was until very recently banned, and there's still restrictions in place for civil servants, so for state employees, to wear the veil. The headscarf ban at university campuses has been lifted, but it is still in some areas, it's still in place. And there's a lot of social stigma associated with it as well, wearing the veil. And it's similarly seen as a sign of oppression. It's something that is traditional, backwards, and it's associated with this, different kind of mentality that is anti-democratic.
And yet, obviously, there are many societies in which the veil is perhaps almost universal for women. Yes?
That's right. That's right. In Egypt, for instance, most people today wear the veil. When I go to Egypt, I'm always shocked at how I'm one of the only few people who is not wearing a headscarf. And oftentimes I'm mistaken for a Copt, for a Christian. Because I'm not wearing anything on my hair.
Here, maybe it would be interesting to talk about different kinds of veiling, because in Turkey as well, about 60 to 65% of women use some kind of head covering, some kind of headscarf. But then there are differences in style and differences in the extent of covering. That becomes a very big question. So you have a whole range of different styles, from just tying a scarf loosely under the chin with a knot that reveals some of the hairline and some of the neck, to complete, full coverage of the body and the hair, everything in a black, chador-like covering called çarşaf in Turkish, to the new kind of fashionable styles of veiling that pay a lot of attention to not showing even one strand of hair, and it's much more complete kind of coverage of the neck and the hairline, and even going down to the shoulders.
Well, and one particular thing that I want to touch on is the recent ban in France that was enacted, because it really gets at a couple of the things that we've just been talking about here, where it seems that the ban that was enacted, and this was specifically for face covering veils, if I understand correctly, it was enacted by supporters who felt that banning it would be an act of liberation for women. And yet many women who wear the veil felt that it was just the opposite.
That's right.
You want to speak to that?
Yeah. The ban on the face veil, so what is called on the niqab, which is the veil that covers both the hair, of course, and the neck, but also the face and leaving only the eye open. So that was enacted in France in 2010 after a ban in Belgium. And it's a ban in all public spaces, including streets, mall, shops, just anywhere. And it was believed to be a liberation, because there is like a feminist argument that is brought in and that has been very much spoken about in the media and by the politicians, precisely in order to be able to pass that law, saying that they are seeking to liberate and free Muslim women. And there are some feminist organizations, a Muslim feminist organization in France, who have supported that move. And that has led even more credence to the politicians to say, we are liberating Muslim women by forcing them to unveil their face.
And Banu, I mean, you mentioned this earlier. What are the what one might call, I suppose, feminist arguments for being able to choose to wear the veil?
The feminist argument, the liberal feminism, is basically saying it's up to the woman to make a decision about what to wear. So it's completely up to the woman. It's understood within the realm of civil liberties and human rights. And there's also, of course, a critical stance towards the state deciding for the women what they should wear and how they should act. And so it's seen as also the state interfering with the lives of women and regulating women's bodies, as we know happens so often in many contexts. So that is the argument of liberal feminism. There are also Islamically oriented feminist organizations in Turkey and in other places that say, that make a similar argument. But some of them, interestingly, also point out that this is not just simple matter of choice either, that it is also a matter of, you know, religious requirement. So it's, you know, so they further support this, you know, combined the idea of freedom with the idea of religious requirement and emphasize its significance, veiling significance for religion, which kind of creates a tension.
Well, we're going to talk more about that, as well as the veil in fashion and in art, when we come back from a break. This is The State of Things. We're discussing the politics and culture of the Muslim headscarf. Sahara Mehr, professor of Asian studies and French and Francophone studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Banu Gurk-Araksel is a professor of geography at UNC Chapel Hill. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. We'll be right back. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Isaac Davey Aronson, in for Frank Statio. Today we're talking about varied and complex perspectives on the Muslim headscarf or veil. Sahara Mehr is professor of Asian studies and French and Francophone studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Banu Gurk-Araksel is a professor of geography there. They're both organizers of the conference Reorienting the Veil. Before we took a break, we were talking about the concept of feminism and the veil, and how women who wear the veil can see it as in fact a feminist act. And Sahara, I know you wanted to say something about that.
Yes, I think it's important to recognize the fact that there are many different types of feminism, that the notion of feminism as simply less clothing, or therefore no head covering, no face covering, that's veiling, is one actually that exists also in Muslim majority society. There are some feminists who believe that liberation and feminism comes with unveiling. And that's, for example, the situation that Turkey took in the 1920s. That's also Iran in the 1920s had a very similar movement. Egypt in the 1920s has a very similar movement. But at the same time that this is one perspective, there is also various other perspectives, like Banu said, about veiling as empowering the woman, and particularly giving her the choice to choose to veil or not to veil. And there's also, I think, since the 1980s, one of the reasons why veiling really has took off in Egypt, certainly, but in other Muslim majority society, is that it allowed women to move about in the public space and to occupy positions that up to then were maybe close to them or only male occupied jobs. Women education was hugely on the rise. And so now they had diplomas and they had college degrees and they were educated in government jobs, for example, or in the private sector. And so veiling allowed many conservative families to allow their daughters to go outside and work and be in co-ed environments with men. And so for many of them, veiling is a way to become financially independent and to make money and to work. So that's also one aspect of feminism that we should remember.
What's interesting to me about that is that it and tying it back to what we were talking about earlier with women who wear the veil, it often still ends up being their defining characteristic in the eyes of observers. And, you know, just this morning, I heard a report on the BBC NewsHour here on WUNC about a young girl wearing a headscarf who went to a soccer match in Britain, and the cameras picked her out because she was the only person in the soccer match wearing a headscarf. And then she was being interviewed on the BBC because this seemed to be a big story that she would be doing that. But I guess the reason for that, I would guess, is that there's this question of what you were saying. Okay, so wearing the headscarf allows women in traditional societies to go out, and in more traditional or more conservative societies to go out and work when they wouldn't be able to. But if you're living in Western society, in Britain or in the U.S., and you just want to go to a soccer match, et cetera, why then wear it?
I mean, that's a very good question. In many ways, that's what led me to take off my scarf, 30 years ago. So I think that there are many Muslim women also who feel that wearing a headscarf becomes too much of a burden, too much of a responsibility, and they do end up taking off their scarf. And it's a big stigma in the Muslim communities. And so I think that it's something that is not often spoken about taking off the veil and having the courage to take off the veil. But I also think that there is also, of course, other perspectives on it, and who would lead some women to actually maintain their scarf. And they can be either identity reasons for like maintaining their cultural religious identity, to affirm their belonging to a religion that they are proud of. Sometimes it's for political perspective, precisely because the society around them does not allow it. They want to show that it has very positive reasons. So I guess this girl in the soccer match also, she is just a normal girl, who goes to a soccer match, that she actually plays soccer. So that's like a new perspective that people often don't think about.
I think the question there to me is why the host or BBC was so shocked to see a veiled woman at a soccer game. There's like actually nothing that is contradictory to Islam or, Muslim practice to be at a soccer game. But there's this, I think it reveals the assumptions made about veiled women, that they live a completely different kind of life that is, very different from the lives of the of a regular person in Britain, right? Like a non-Muslim or a non-veiled Muslim person in Britain. But as that woman was saying in the BBC story, she likes soccer, she plays soccer, and, this is, they're just, human beings. In a way, we're fighting against this perception of Muslim women as something other than just human beings with their pleasures, different desires, with their own contradictions and ambivalences. Our research is trying to show that, women, veiled women are, complex beings, and veiling has so many different kinds of meanings for them.
On that point, the veil has made its way into different forms of contemporary art, and I want to speak about that in a moment. But first, I want to talk about how it's made its way into even stand-up comedy. And I have a clip here from the comedian Shazia Mirza talking about how she's perceived when wearing a burqa.
Denmark recently, and I got on the plane with my burqa on, dressed like this, and this woman, she refused to sit next to me. So I said to her, I'm going to sit on this plane and blow it up, and you think you're going to be safer three rows back?
The comedian Shazia Mirza, and and wow, there's so much going on there. And you could hear when she said, I'm going to sit on this plane, I'm going to blow it up, the very nervous, nervous laughter in the audience. I mean, Sahar, a lot of Shazia Mirza's, comedy comments on her, she comments on herself being Muslim, poking fun at herself. What do you think the emergence of someone like that means? And I imagine that it means something different in the Muslim and non-Muslim worlds. Mm.
Well, I think comedy is one of the most wonderful tools that I think has emerged to try to speak about some topics that are very difficult to speak about or that are taboo. And there are many different comedians today who speak about various topics related to Muslims and the stereotypes of Muslims as suicide bombers or violent or exotic women or oppressed women. And topics like that. And so I think that it's wonderful to have that because as the comedians themselves say, when we laugh together, we can then, you know, be humans together and we can face topics together. This is certainly one of my students' favorite media when I teach my classes, and I'm teaching one on veiling right now, and this is one of their favorite parts.
Can you talk a little bit about other contemporary art that's being inspired by veiling?
Yeah, there is some poetry. There is a new what I would call a new hijab poetry genre. Not much of it, but definitely an emerging genre that talks that treats veiling from the perspective of Muslim women and their struggle to be to fight the stereotypes that non-Muslims have about them, so as oppressed, as suicide bombers, as sexualized, but also the stereotypes that many Muslims have, or the obsession that Muslims themselves have about the rituals of the faith, the very specificity of the conservative clothing that you must wear, and they want to express much more their spirituality, their humility in front of God. And so these are like the progressive Muslims, what we call the progressive Muslims, who are the group of Muslims around the world who are committed to redefining the faith and to peel off layers of interpretation and misinterpretations that have been superimposed upon the religious texts.
I want to just ask you about one particular artist. The artist Todd Drake is participating in the conference today and tomorrow and at UNC, and his work's been on display at the Global FedEx Center at UNC. Just talk a little bit about his work and what it adds to a conversation on Muslim identity.
Yeah, I'm very excited that Todd Drake is participating at the conference. He's a human rights artist, and actually he will be speaking tonight at the conference. And he has done, one of his projects is called Esse Quam Videri, which is the North Carolina state motto, to be rather than to seem. And basically what he did is like Muslim self-portraits. So he has been working with various Muslims, and he started in North Carolina at UNC with Muslim students, and working with them towards making their own self-portraits with whatever tools that they feel would give their image justice. And this is like in order to contrast it and to oppose the many centuries when non-Muslims and Westerners in general have spoken for and represented Muslims themselves. So this is Muslims by themselves.
And the images are quite interesting. They're very striking in the way that joy is represented in these photographs. That was maybe the one thing that struck to me, because the veil is also often associated with being really serious, solemn. You know, there's something, you know, hidden. And you don't really see smiling women wearing the veil. But in these images, you know, women, you know, a team of women playing basketball and just smiling. That's what's actually on our poster. And other women who are just looking straight at the camera, straight into your eyes. And their, you know, their self-confidence and the pleasure of life, you know, that they take in life just comes across. And they're wonderful, wonderful self-portraits. Mm-hmm.
We're talking about reorienting the veil, the subject of a conference at UNC with Sahara Mehr and Banu Gurkaraksel. And Banu, I wanted to ask you, I mean, you were talking about UNC students being, Sahara, you were talking about the UNC students being the self-portrait artists in some of these. And have you found, I have heard anecdotal evidence, and I don't know, Banu, if you found in your research or if both of you find just with your students at UNC that there's a generational shift in which younger Muslim women who perhaps come from quite secular, westernized, if you will, families are turning back to the veil or turning to the veil in ways that their parents' generation perhaps gave up. Have you seen that?
I've seen actually some of that in the classes that I've taught regularly over the years. A class that I regularly teach is called Gender in the Middle East, and I usually get some students who are who are Muslims and who come from different kinds of families, and I've a couple of them have actually started to take the veil on. as the, you know, years progress. So I've actually witnessed that happen, and that was something that their, you know, parents' generation didn't do necessarily, but it was to them an important part of being Muslim and practicing Islam. And that really resonates with what I found in my research in Turkey as well, that the veil is actually taken really seriously by the women, especially in this context of, you know, the politicization of the veil. And it's not just a piece of garment that you just take on, you know, and it put on and take off, but it's, you know, it's a lot is invested in the veil itself and the practice of veiling. So a lot of, you know, people who also were in my research talked about, you know, how significant it was to cultivate piety, to cultivate Islamic virtues in themselves through the practice of veiling. So it's not just, you know, a symbol or something to take on and off, but it's seen as an integral part of becoming pious Muslims.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I would add to that I think it's also part from what I witness in my student is part of the second generation. Oftentimes the first generation, when they come, they try to assimilate, maybe not even teach their kids Arabic, for example, if it's Arabic or whatever the native tongue is, and try to be really good Americans, to completely be assimilated. And then it's the second generation that we see, for example, populate our Arabic classes. And many of them are definitely involved in a re-exploration and a reconnection with what they feel is their cultural background. And so some of them definitely take on veil, but we can't say that it's, you know, all of them.
Right, sure. No. And of course, and that's not unique, of course, to Muslims or people
right.
from the Arab world, but across cultures and religions
right.
that come to
That's
the U.S.
And it's, you know, connected to this much broader movement to be more conscious,
right.
conscious,
mm-hmm.
knowledgeable Muslims,
right.
to do things more fully.
Yeah.
So briefly, in the context of people taking it so seriously and as something so significant, I also want to talk about the veil in the fashion mm-hmm. world. Bano, you've done a lot of research on the way that mm-hmm. the fashion world has produced and marketed headscarves, particularly in Turkey. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. This is a project that I've been doing with my collaborator, Anna Sikor, at the University of Kentucky, and we've done research in 2008-2009 particularly. And that project was very much about, you know, within this political context and also the rise of consumer capitalism in Turkey especially, we witnessed this diversification of what we call veiling fashion. So these veiling styles that are increasingly, you know, stylish. They are chic. They change with the seasons. And our research looked at how they are produced, so the companies who are involved in the production of these styles and how they relate to their products, how they market them, what kinds of they organize fashion shows, they produce catalogs, they post videos, advertisement videos on their websites. So we analyzed those. We also talked to veiled women who participate in this veiling consumption culture and wear these styles. And what we found is maybe there were several really interesting results to us. One of them was that the companies are actually quite different in the way that they relate to their product. Some profess a more Islamic mission and see their product as an Islamic commodity, and their goal is to change society, but of course make profits at the same time. But some others were actually quite, you know, they were just in the apparel business, and this was just business to them, and they were, you know, interested in this new market that was growing, and this is a growing market. So the companies have expanded their production and pushing the limits of what counts as veiling in the meantime, in terms of colors, in terms of cuts, in terms of the different styles. Among women, we actually saw them speaking a lot about the contradictions that they feel about this combination of veiling and fashion. Going into the research, I expected personally to find, you know, women to say, this is perfectly fine. I can be very pious Muslim, very devout Muslim, and I can be fashionable. I don't see a contradiction. But that wasn't the case at all. The women's discussions very much focused on, you know, this conflict that they felt, even as they wore the fashionable styles. They said, all of them, every woman that we spoke to said, they're wearing the veil because of religious conviction. It is a religious practice, no question about that. But then how exactly they wore it, what kind of style that they adopted, was related to questions of politics, questions of aesthetics, you know, what kinds of accessories were used. And they talked about these contradictions that they felt themselves and how those contradictions became very important to them and to their piety in their past to God that they had committed to, how they were trying to, you know, bring those things together and find a much more maybe unity, a harmony. They talked a lot about harmony between their appearance and their inner piety, their appearance and their conduct. So that was really important to them, trying to, you know, to harmonize their lives.
It's, I mean, many people in the U.S. might say that fashion is a religious experience for them, but I think that not quite in that way. I think that's actually sounds like a religious experience. Mm-hmm. Well, so much more to talk about, and the conference is called Reorienting the Veil, and it's today and tomorrow at UNC Chapel Hill, looking at the Muslim headscarf through an interdisciplinary lens. Sahara and Banu, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you a lot for having us.
Sahara Mehra is Professor of Asian Studies and French and Francophone Studies at UNC Chapel Hill. Banu Gurk-Araxel is a professor of geography there. Once again, the conference is Reorienting the Veil. This is The State of Things, and just ahead, music from the Over Mountain Men. Stay tuned.
Reached a sad moment to bid you farewell. The enemy comes now like lions they close in. I must leave you now for the warmer land. Warmer land.